This story is called He Who Loses His Life. The initials EBR. He's known as Bob, New York City. This story appears on page 540 in the second edition and page 531 in the third edition of the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. An ambitious playwright, he let his brains get so far ahead of his emotions that he collapsed into suicidal drinking. To learn to live, he nearly died. Bob, as he calls himself in his story, found AA and stopped drinking in January 1947. He wrote an update of his story for the September 1967 AA Grapevine, which he signed with the initials EBR. He had wanted to be a great author and write plays, but was stuck in a job he hated with people he disliked. Disappointed with his life, he decided to kill himself, but instead decided to drink himself to death. Instead, he drank himself into lost jobs, jails, hospitals, and heavy debt. At the point he first went into AA, it had not worked for him, because he had not worked for AA. His serious drinking lasted 7 or 8 years. After recovery, he entered a new field, perhaps alcoholism, in which he taught and about which he published a book. He still wanted to write a fine play. In his 1967 update, he reported, "The bad years of suffocating in the deep morass of alcoholism are years I could have used to good advantage had I not been trapped by this hideous disease." There were 7 or 8 years before I found AA. Oh, how I could have used those years. But they were not wasted. They stripped me of everything, including self-respect, but they made me ready for the happiness of the last 20 years in AA. In September 1967, the AA Grapevine Big Book Stories, updated 2 of 5. This is the second article in the Grapevine's new series by authors of the personal histories in the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. First published in 1939, a revised enlarged Big Book was published in 1955. Now, 12 years later, the author of He Who Loses His Life, page 540 in the revised second edition, looks back over 20 years plus of sobriety. Come on, be happy too. 20 years later. Dry, one day at a time, for 20 years? Once that would have seemed an unendurable sentence to be faced. In retrospect, the years have been so busy, so happy, so full of fulfillment that no one of those 7,300 days has been long enough. And I have been happy, not frivolously and determinedly cheerful, but deep down happy. A happiness so basic that it can withstand the occasional shocks of anger, frustration, impatience, and bone fatigue that once would have sent me to the nearest and quickest alcoholic escape. 15 years ago, I wrote my story for the Big Book. In it, I said that I belong to the school of AA thought, which teaches that successful membership in AA frees us, so that we may range the world, in a manner of speaking, like any other human being. Practically expressed, this viewpoint means that I do not feel the necessity of going to meetings constantly. I go whenever I have a 12-step case to work with. I never turn down a 12-step case. And on my anniversary, I do not go out looking for 12-step cases as a means of ensuring my continuing sobriety. Yet I always tell my new friends and even casual strangers, when I am in their company and they are having a drink, why I do not drink. I am in AA. A friend has remarked that she considers me the alcoholic the least anonymous she's ever heard of. This procedure has brought me more than a few 12-step cases. Always it elicits inquiries and usually intense interest about the unorganized organization called AA. If there's an interest, I explain briefly my own experience before and after joining AA. Smile, accept congratulations, secretly giving thanks inside myself for the philosophy I have hooked onto. For I am hooked on AA. That is the most certain thing I know, and it makes me happy to shoot arrows into the air. I also believe that as soon as they are a bit competent in AA, the newcomers should carry the 12-step work. That's how I got well, doing constant and intense 12-step work, privately, in groups, and in hospitals. I did it for a number of years, joyously. Now when I acquire a new customer, as soon as it's sensible to do so, I transfer him to an AA member younger in AA than I am, and so, I am convinced, provide him with some of the help and opportunity he needs to better himself as well as the new candidate. I keep liquor in my home and serve it to friends. I literally do not want any. It's no deprivation for me to act as bartender for everyone except myself. I go to cocktail parties early and I leave early, before my friends and other guests get silly and argumentative and boring. I have served my time paying back for the boredom I inflicted on others when I got drunk. Sometimes I pick up a 12-step case at one of these parties. Anyone tailing me as I move around the big city where I live might think me a liar and a hypocrite, for on occasion I go alone into a bar. The answer is simple. From the old bad days, I know where the washrooms are, and, of course, when you gotta go, you gotta go. American cities are notoriously short of this kind of convenience. The most likely place is always in a bar. My intent in writing such details is hopefully to reassure the candidate for AA who hesitates about coming to that first meeting or keeping on coming. Joining AA does not mean to me the taking of perpetual vows of abstinence through years that loom ahead bleakly. Of course, this is why we have the 24-hour plan. But even so, 2 years before I achieved sobriety in AA, a friend told me not to come near her again until I had been sober for 10 years. I yelled, "I'd rather be dead than face such a terrible future." Her reply did not comfort me. "Keep on as you are, and you will be dead." I knew that, but I did not know that in achieving sobriety in AA, I'd also achieve the freest kind of freedom, if freedom can be qualified. I would achieve the freedom of choice. I'd, like all hesitant candidates, to know that and to accept it, that they are not necessarily committing themselves to a life of bondage, however healing that bondage might be. No one would be in despair because his body cannot handle strawberries. Well, my body just can't handle alcohol, that's all. It so happens I've had a gallbladder out and I can't eat grapes, but that circumstance does not make me contemplate suicide. The doctors assure me that my past drinking had nothing to do with the gallbladder trouble for any possible curious readers of this essay. Now, while I go to meetings only occasionally, I use AA daily, hourly, I might say, every waking hour of my life. I have to deal with a lot of people. Frequently, I am in a position of being able to help them in many ways. Thanks to AA, I am more tolerant and, I hope, more understanding of others. A certain former impatience is minimized. I'm working on it. The sarcasm is replaced by, at least in intention, wit, or maybe just good humor, good nature. I hope I am easier to live with. And behind the anonymity of this essay, I will confess to a joy that approaches smugness in performing good deeds, also kept anonymous if possible. You wouldn't think that at my age anyone could be so naive. Ah, truly, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Let not your right hand know what your left hand doeth. Retire to a private place for your prayers. Bread cast on waters and so on. Believe me, it's all true. At least it's true for me. Selfishly, for me, the best is that I'm in command. No compulsion by anything drives me to actions that I don't really want to do, don't approve of, and know are wrong. I hope I am no less human for being dry, 20 years plus dry in AA. The bad old years, the years of suffocating in the deep morass of alcoholism, are years I could have used to good advantage had I not been trapped by this hideous disease. There were 7 or 8 years before I found AA. Oh, how I could have used those years. But they were not wasted. They stripped me of everything, including self-respect, but they made me ready for the happiness of the last 20 years in AA. Come on, man, join us. Be happy, too. All you have to do to change your life is change your mind. Signed, EBR, Manhattan, New York. And now the story, He Who Loses His Life. An ambitious playwright, his brains got so far ahead of his emotions that he collapsed into suicidal drinking. To learn to live, he nearly died. I remember the day when I decided to drink myself to death quietly, without bothering anyone, because I was tired of having been a dependable, trustworthy person for about 39 years without having received what I thought was a proper reward for my virtue. That was the day, that was the decision, I know now, when I crossed over the line and became an active alcoholic. Perhaps a better way of saying it is that on that day, with that decision, I no longer fought drinking as an escape. Rather, I embraced it. I must in honesty admit it with a great sense of relief. I no longer had to pretend. I was giving up the struggle. Things weren't going as I thought they should for my greater enjoyment, comfort, and fame. Therefore, if the universe wouldn't play my way, I wouldn't play at all. I, a man of steel, with very high ideals, well brought up, an honor student, and the recipient of scholarships and prizes, a boy wonder in business, I, Bob, the author of this essay, looked and saw that the universe was beneath my contempt, and that to remove myself from it was the only thing of dignity a man could do. Since perhaps suicide was a bit too drastic, actually I was afraid, dry martinis were chosen as the slow, pleasant, private, gradual instrument of self-destruction. And it was nobody's business, nobody's but mine, so I thought. Within a month, the police, the hospital authorities, several kind strangers, most of my friends, all of my close relatives, and a few adepts at rolling a drunk and removing his wristwatch and wallet had been involved. There was a time for about 3 months when I bought a $10 wristwatch every payday, that is, every 2 weeks. Since it was wartime, I explained to the somewhat startled shopkeeper that I had many friends in service whom I was remembering with a watch. Perhaps without realizing it, I was. On that day of decision, I didn't acknowledge that I was an alcoholic. My proud southern blood would have boiled if anyone had named me such a despicable thing. No, it can best be explained in a little phrase I coined and sang to myself. What happened to Bob? Bob found alcohol. And having sung that phrase, I'd chuckle with amusement, turning into irony, turning into self-contempt, turning into self-pity at the sad fate of Bob, that wonderful, poor little motherless boy who was so smart in school and grew up to accept responsibility so early and so fast, and who staggered under his burdens without a whimper until the time came when he thought he was too good for this world and so he ought to be out of it. Poor Bob. That was one aspect of it, and a true one. There were several others. There was loneliness. There was the necessity for sticking to a job I hated, a dull, repetitive job performed in association with other men I had nothing in common with, performed for years on end because the money was needed at home. There was the physical aspect, to be the youngest and the runt of the brood of children, to have to wear glasses very early, and so to be teased, to be bookish and bored in school because the captain of the football team could not translate Virgil, and yet was school god while you little shrimp, were the school egghead, junior size, and an early model. There was the father one lost respect for at the age of 11 because the father broke his solemn word in a circumstance where you, 11 years old, had assumed guilt when you were innocent. But the father would not believe you, no matter what, and to ease his suffering, you confessed and were forgiven, only months later to have your guilt brought up only he and you knew what he was talking about, brought up in front of the stern grandmother. The sacred word was broken, and you never trusted your father again and avoided him. And when he died, you were unmoved. You were 35 before you understood your father's horrible anguish and forgave him and loved him again. For you learned that he had been guilty of the thing he had accused you of, and his guilt had brought suffering to his entire family. And he thought he saw his young son beginning his own tragic pattern. These things were all pressures, for by 35 I had been drinking for a few years. The pressures had started long ago. Sometimes we are told in AA not to try and learn the reasons for our drinking, but such is my nature, that I must know the reason for things. And I didn't stop until I had satisfied myself about the reasons for my drinking. Only, having found them, I threw them away and ordered another extra dry martini. For to have accepted the reasons and to have acted on them would have been too great a blow to my ego, which was as great in reverse as my body was small. In my 20s, I found Edna St. Vincent Millay's verse, "Pity me the heart that is slow to learn what the quick mind sees at every turn." That couplet contains most of my reasons for drinking. There was the love affair, which was ridiculous. Imagine that midget being able to fall in love. And my head knew it, while my heart pumped real, genuine anguish, for it hurt like hell. And since it was first love, things have never been quite the same. There was the overweening ambition to be the world's greatest author, when at 39 I had nothing of importance to say to the world. There was the economic fear, which made me too timid to take any action which might improve my circumstances. There was the sense of being misunderstood, when, as a matter of fact, by my mid-20s, I was quite popular, although I hadn't grown much bigger physically, but the feeling was a crutch, an excuse. It was my secret garden. Bluntly, it was my retreat from life, and I didn't want to give it up. For a while, for a long time, we can endure the intellects being ahead of the emotions, which is the import of Millay's couplet. But as the years go by, the stretch becomes unbearable, and the man with the grown-up brain and the childish emotions, vanity, self-interest, false pride, jealousy, longing for social approval, to name a few, becomes a prime candidate for alcohol. To my way of thinking, this is a definition of alcoholism, a state of being in which the emotions have failed to grow to the stature of the intellect. I know there are some alcoholics who seem terribly, terribly grown up, but I think that they are trying to make themselves think they are grown up, and the strain of their effort is what is causing them to drink a sense of inadequacy. A childish vanity to be the most popular, the most sought after, the mostest of the most. And all this, of course, is, in the popular modern jargon, compensation for immaturity. I wish I knew a shortcut to maturity, but I wanted a cosmos, a universe, all my own, which I had created, and where I reigned as chief, top reigner, and ruler over everyone else, which is only another way of saying I had to be right all the time. And only God can be that. Okay, I wanted to be God. I still do. I want to be one of His children, a member of the human race. And as a child is a part of his father, so do I now want to be a part of God. For always, over and above everything else, was the awfulness of the lack of meaning in life. Now, for me, and to my satisfaction, I know the purpose of life. The purpose of life is to create, and the byproduct is happiness. To create, everyone does it, some at the instinct level, others in the arts. My personal definition, which I submit as applying only to myself, although everyone is welcome to it who wants it, includes every waking activity of the human being. To have a creative attitude towards things is a more exact meaning. To live and to deal with other human beings creatively, which to me means seeing the God in them and respecting and worshiping this God. If I write with the air of one who has discovered the obvious, which is to say the eternal truths which have been offered to us since the beginning, forgive my callowness. I had to find these things out for myself. Alas, for us men toward whom Shaw hurled his cry, must a Christ be crucified in every generation for the benefit of those who have no imagination? My serious drinking covered about 7 years. In those years I was in jail 9 times, in an alcoholic ward overnight 2 times, and I was fired from 3 jobs, 2 of them very good ones. As I write these words, it seems incredible that these things should have happened to me, for they are, truly, against all my instincts and training. Well, I started to cross out that last sentence, but decided to let it stand. What a revelation of ego and arrogance still remaining in me, as if anyone, instinct and training apart, likes to be in jail or in an alcoholic ward or fired from his job. After nearly 8 years of sobriety in AA, I still can set down such thoughts against my instinct and training, showing that I still consider myself a special person, entitled to special privileges. I ask the forgiveness of the reader, and from now on I shall try to write with the humility I honestly pray for. A pattern established itself. I was never a secret drinker, and I never kept a bottle at home. I'd visit one bar after another, having 1 martini in each, and in each hoping to find someone interesting to talk to. Actually, of course, I wanted someone to listen to me, because when I had a few martinis inside, I became a great author I longed to be. And the right listener was in for some pretty high-flown theories of literature and of genius. If the listener were drunk enough, the lecture might go on through several martinis, which I was glad to pay for. If he were still sober, chances are that very quickly I put him down as a Philistine with no appreciation of literacy genius, and then I went on to another bar to find a new victim. So it was that in alcohol I found fulfillment. For a little while I was the great man I wanted to be, and thought myself entitled to be just by reason of being me. I wonder if there ever has been a sillier reason for getting drunk all the time. Sobering up, the mind that was ahead of the emotions would impel